I think I want to start there, though. I do want to frame it for the audience about how it is the three of us met and, like, how are we still together after all these years? I mean, I think it's a valid question because, you know, I think people want to know, y'all don't live near me or each other for that matter. How did we meet? How does this relationship, you know, stay the course?
I love it. Now, in my own mind, was it summer 2018?
19.
Okay, that makes more sense. Okay. Because I know I was doing the program at Columbia, but I've been there 2 summers. 2019. Okay.
Yeah. So who wants to tell the story? Because I was invited last minute to meet you, Lawrence. Very last minute. Like, Stacia and Ginny were walking out the door and we're like, yo, you want to come? And they're like, come
on. You need to know this man. Yeah. You need to know this man.
Exactly. That's exactly what Ginny was saying.
You know, the funniest part is, in like, virtual hug to her, the person probably best suited to tell the story isn't even here.
I know. Shout out to Stacia.
Yeah.
So, we got to get our shout outs out. Shout out to Courtney because they scorch us later on when we don't give them shout outs.
But you know what, Melina? I actually, just a thought, not a vote, is I actually think the fragmented recollections of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Speak to both who we are, but also how we met. Because, like, I don't know how you got there.
Mm.
I knew Ginny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was talking to Stacia.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't. And then Ginny knows where she was. And you know you got yanked out the door.
I did.
But I think that, both in truth, but also on display, is also probably reflective of not so happenstance.
Mm.
And then the beauty that came after it. Because
yeah.
Then Ginny and I would have known each other way before then.
That's true. That is very true. All right, who wants to go first? Let's do it.
I mean, I'll start because I feel like this is... when I think about how we're all sitting here today, I think about how so many different things had to happen for us to come into each other's orbit and stay. And I think that's what's so wild is the ways our paths crossed before we even knew it. And then at the right moment, we all came to know each other in different ways. So I started when I was the director of the Office of Equity and Inclusion at Holderness School up in central northern New Hampshire. And I was new to the position. I was still new to independent schools. I had no idea how to connect with other people. And we held a students of color conference for students of color in northern New England, where it can be really difficult to connect with people who are experiencing similarities to you. And I have to share one of my favorite first stories of Lawrence that I don't know if he's ever heard, but I actually shared it earlier today when we were talking about planning an event for something else, because someone was really nervous about the event. And I said, you know, I remember the moment for me that changed. And I was so situated in the idea that I had to be like in control of the conference or it would go wrong, that I didn't realize that that was a response to my whiteness and my white feminism. And we were hosting an unconference. We had about 120 kids there. And Lawrence was there with a group of kids, as was Melissa Lawler, who we shouted out last time. And it was this moment where we did this unconference thing. So we asked the students as they were coming in, as they were eating dinner, to write down what they would like to have workshops and discussions about. And then there's this crazy moment where we have Dr. Nicole Furlong actually speaking to the young people. And while that was happening, I was in the background trying to organize what classrooms we were going to use and what the discussions, the topics, the workshops would be. This takes place in about 10-minute process. And we come back out. I put up on the screen, here's where the first round is going to be. Here's where the second round is going to be. And assigned all the classrooms ready to go. Adults were assigned to go in, point. And so we said, basically, like, disperse. Like, you've picked the topics, go find a spot. I don't even know if you remember this, Lawrence. And there was a little classroom outside the auditorium that was for about, 15, 20 students. And then all of a sudden, there are 40 students trying to fit in a room to talk about interracial dating at independent schools. And they all came back into the auditorium and they were like, what do we do? And like, my whiteness, my white feminism, and my Virgo came out all at once.
Oh, God.
And and I was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. Half of you need to go somewhere else, and half of you are going to stay for this. And Lawrence was just sitting back in the chair in the auditorium, kind of got his arm up. And he looks at me and he goes, why don't you just let them stay if they want to be here? And I was like, you're so right. Like, why am I trying to control this? Like, people try to control these kids' lives all day long. And so that's what we did. And that was my first real like moment where I was like, this person is special. And then I remember walking out later and getting into this conversation with Lawrence. And from that point on, we were this little network in northern New England, supporting each other in all of the ways that we weren't receiving support, where we created community, where we felt isolated.
What year was this, Jenny?
Oh, this was 2015, 2016, I think. So it was, wow, Lawrence, we've been at this for a minute.
A decade.
Thank goodness we don't look like what we've been through. I mean, Jenny,
Ain't that the truth?
I love you, and I have so many fond memories, and then beautiful post-it notes that I get reminded of. I remember bringing my family, as well as myself, in a moving van to northern New Hampshire, and I remember passing Boston. And topographically, it literally was like a whole new world. I can hear Peabo Bryson in my ear. We weren't traveling by the mountains. We were going to a school literally in the mountains. And, in this reflection, there's no shade to New Hampshire. I think for folks who are native and have affinity to the area, it's absolutely beautiful. It's just very different than where I was accustomed to. And in getting there, again, as DEI happens to us, we don't happen to it or pack it up in the moving van with an agenda. I was a director of college counseling. There immediately became the need for someone to lead DEI work there. And racially, spatially, and professionally, I couldn't have felt more isolated. And as isolation does, a lot of us as practitioners end up doing really important, really exhausting work in silos, and we end up reinventing the wheel. And so, as I started to vision 1 year, 2 year, 3 years down the line, things we could be doing at our little campus in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, I heard about this school down Highway 93, the Holderness School, and the beautiful cultural inertia of what was happening there. And Jenny, you should hear this. I heard about your name second. I heard about your work first. And at this place, there was a student leadership conference for students of color, for LGBTQIA students. My students, I want to say, were motivated by the conference. They also heard there was a dance, and they could put a little boogie in it. But whatever it was, there were things happening. And from a personal and professional perspective, the relationship with Jenny Rae Sparkman, it saved me. It saved me from the cultural, professional, spatial isolation. It really gave me a sibling, a friend in arms. And I couldn't be more grateful for the way that we met. Now, that does nothing to explain red lip here, there. we work for Melina. She'll say work with, we work. So how did this person become our boss summer of 2019? Yeah. Now, Stacia McFadden, we love you, who is not here, is an important cog in the wheel because Ginny and I knew each other. Mm-hmm. Ginny and Stacia and then Melina are in this cohort program at Klingstein in the summer. I coincidentally, and this is just my part of the recollection, and I would love you all to chime in after, we heard that good friends were in the same space. We just need to be together in the same space at the same time. And so we were all on campus in different places at Columbia. For those of you who know the Upper West Side, if you go down from campus, there was a really cool restaurant that I think was just after Tom's Diner. For folks who understand the television, at least the relevance of Tom's Diner. And we met for dinner. In walked Ginny, who I knew. In walked Stacia, who I knew that I knew. But then there's this other person, Melina, who I didn't know. And that was the last time we were strangers. And it feels like we've been family ever since. But I get old and I forget things. I would love to know, maybe Melina, what your recollection of this collection was like.
So I met Ginny in summer 2018 at the National Diversity Practitioner Institute that the Glasgow Group puts on in Maryland. Shout out to Rodney. and so Ginny and I and like 75 of our closest friends spent 3 days together, three long days together. Loved the learning, but they were long days. And the next summer I was at Kling and in walked Ginny and I was like, oh, you're here. What are you doing here? like how serendipitous. And I did not know Stacia. So Stacia was a stranger to me when I started Klingenstein in 2019. So one day, whatever, we'd spent too much time in class and we wanted to go unwind before we studied till 3 a.m. And Stacia and Ginny were walking out the door and I don't know, we just were chatting and they were like, hey, you should come. We're going to go meet Lawrence. And Ginny said, you need to know him. And I was like, sure, let's do it. And so we walked down and I met Lawrence. And I knew at that time, all I knew of you was that you were directing like some section of camp at Columbia during the summer. And I don't know. I think I'll let Ginny speak to how her and Stacia ended up organizing this.
Well, I think that, and we're going to give Stacia another set of flowers because if you don't know Stacia McFadden, you probably will shortly. In part because I show up at Klingenstein not knowing if I'm smart enough, not knowing if I'm good enough, knowing that I care enough. Mm-hmm. And in that process, it was one of the very first days and I had no idea what to do. I'm like, what do I do for lunch? Like, I'm staying up in Harlem. Like,
they don't feed you for 60 grand. They do not feed you.
And Stacia just invited me to do things with her. And she was the first person that really talked to me at Klingenstein. And then I don't think that there's any way to figure out how we all ended up at the same table together. But there was this moment where, you know, we had this assignment where we had to do something longer than it was comfortable. And we all stayed together with several other people until like 9 o'clock at night in a classroom. And once you've done some, there's just a bonding that happens. And for Melina and I, there was also a moment in that time that was somewhat confrontational, and there was a conflict that happened. And everyone's either like, what do we do? Or, let's just move on to the next class. And then you have your fire starters. And Melina and I said, oh, no. We're going to stop. We're going to run some affinity groups that are unplanned and unsanctioned. And because that's who we are. And that is very much how Melina and I bonded, is over the work. And again, to your point, not because we're called to it, but because it called to us. And so,
Facts.
that day, after that moment, I'm like, oh, no. Melina, you got to know Lawrence.
And we had a good time together. Honestly, it's so politically correct, Lawrence, that you were like, we got together for dinner because I only remember getting together for drinks. So I don't know if I ate. I honestly don't know if I ate that summer because all I remember is ingesting way too much caffeine. That is it. And I lost like 20 pounds that summer walking around New York City for longer than it was comfortable and ingesting too much caffeine and not eating enough. So, my fellow friends, how do we stick together? What makes this relationship tick?
Yeah, I love that. I think coming together and staying together are two different things. There's a lot of people that I've met, they've come and they've gone. They say you don't get to choose your family. And yet I feel like we've chosen each other. In Molina, in two different spaces, I felt a similar experience. What is the plight of knowing that you definitely earned it? What is the plight of being eminently qualified and still in some spaces not feeling like you're enough? A lot of people have that experience. Not a lot of people have the gall to create their own space. And in Molina, I saw this deep realization that if there's going to be a table, I better bring it. And that's the maverick that I am. And there became a deep desire in a world of people who seem to have their own networks and seem to have their own amplifiers. If I was going to be any value as a loudmouth and as a fight promoter, whose business would be any better to get behind than Molina's? And that was before Phillips Collaborative. The idea that we collaborate together lived well before the Articles of Incorporation. And so for me, Molina felt like a friend, felt like a sister, frankly, felt like a cause to get behind in all the ways that make impact in the world. And that's why I stick with this. And then it turns out because Melina is kind of like that, here is Jenny, who is willing. And I think a lot of folks in privileged positions from an intersectional way need to hear this. Jenny is so willing to step aside, so willing to play the back, so willing to cede space for others to have it. And yet we keep denying her of that. And so
We do.
Jenny is,
We drag
Jenny is far more than being brought in our luggage. She is so humble that most people don't know that she actually flies the plane. And so sticking with you all is easy. It's necessary. And in a moment where we're choosing our bunkers and our foxholes, there's not another place, if I'm going to be in a foxhole, than to be with the two of you.
Lovely. My goodness. How are
Little Valentine's Day, razzle dazzle, you know what I
Right.
mean?
A little sprinkle, sprinkle. Okay. All
Yeah.
right. I see you, Lawrence. I I love how we're like loving on each other, you know, recalling how we met and how we keep this thing going.
I think something that's really important for me to add is something that I learned from Melina, which is there's so much to be said for feeding your soul. There's so much to be said for choosing to be with one another, but there's also this intellectual capacity and commitment towards growth that I so appreciate with the two of you. And there's also this honesty. And it's sad to me that that's so rare. But there's this level of honesty with care and accountability that to me says, these are my people, you know? And that we feed all the parts of who we are, that our souls, our hearts, and our minds intellectually, this is the room you want to be in. Mm. This is the room where, you know, James Baldwin is sitting and we start talking about, you know, Malcolm X and Rustin Bayard. And I think that in a time when so much, thankfully, information and intellectualism is happening, I can't say enough about how that's what happens in this room. And there's a willingness. This isn't about repeating things. This is about creating things. And that's what, like, I want people to understand is that this is intellectual liberatory leaders whose voices should not be drowned out, but elevated, because that's what we need right now. Not just a repetition of everything else that's been said over and over again in a different way. And so that drawing together of intellectual action, I think, is something that truly does keep us all together.
I have nothing to add. It's like, what am I supposed to say? It's cool chilling with y'all.
Tell us you love us too. Don't get Valentine's Day. Words of affirmation.
Yeah, I mean, tell us you love us too. This is the easiest job I've ever had. You know what I mean? It's like, who else? I couldn't imagine, you know, doing this work alongside any other people. I feel like you all make me better in all the ways that matter. A better, you know, leader and, you know, a better mom, just a better person, a better practitioner. Iron sharpens iron. And you all are some of the smartest people that I know, caring, and you're not risk averse, because every time I'm like, hey, why don't we try this? Y'all are like, sure, why not? And, you know, why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? And it's always, you know, I love that you all make, you know, ideas better and are willing to be thought leaders in what's turning out to be a wildly risky profession. I don't think, you know, at least in 2018, I never thought we'd be where we are now in terms of being targeted and by the government. And yet here we are. And I don't think that the people we consider to be our ancestors ever thought themselves to be in the same light. But, you know, hindsight's 2020, we know that of them. And so I think, you know, we are steadfast and very serious about, the ancestors we will be. And for me, that makes me, you know, happy in terms of like us thinking about like what our intellectual legacy is, what our love legacy is, and that matters to me. And so I love that y'all, what matters to me matters to y'all. And, you know, you guys, my, you know, everyone knows your names. Everyone knows how important in my life, everyone knows how important you are. And they're like, oh, how do you, you know, how do you manage consultants that, you know, don't live near you or, you know, have full-time jobs? And I'm like, via text? I don't know. Like when Ginny feels like responding, she responds.
When we have to read through all 20 text messages,
yes,
because Lawrence doesn't have one of those special Apple phones. And so there's like, we got to read his reactions.
Yeah. PSA, Lawrence is the Android in our group chat. I know. Oh, man. You know we love him because he's still in the group chat with the green bubble. Whoo, boy. My goodness. That is love in action. It's putting up with him in the group chat. Anyway, so yes. That is how we met. That is how our relationship continues to work. I'm going to pivot real fast and ask you all a question. Actually, I've been dying to ask the both of you. Tell me about your summers growing up. What were your summers like? Where were they? Like, set the scene. I need, like, what games did you play? Who was your homie? Where did you break something at? Were you home before the streetlights came on? Like, questions that need answers.
Yeah, I remember summers, and as a direct corollary, it's interesting how as an African in America, you end up living an experience that ends up in a book. So growing up in Jersey City, New Jersey, with family down in Tifton, Georgia, Southwest Georgia, we lived the handbook for Negro travelers. No one ever told me what sundown towns were, but I can remember from my dad, who was the driver, we would go from New Jersey, carefully curated travel routes, from Jersey to Columbia, South Carolina, which is the space and place that we stayed often. And I used to always wonder why, when he would gas up, he would very sharply, you all better use the bathroom here, you better eat here, because we're not stopping again until we get to X destination. And in my head, I'm like, he's awfully pushy. I have no idea why my dad is such a bug in his butt. I didn't know how he was protecting us. Mm-hmm. And over time, I would listen, because as a child, you are seen and not heard. Us gentle parents have made some mistakes. And I would hear in the backseat the conversation my dad and mom were having in front of in the front seat of the car about towns that were definitely not stopping in. From the ancestors, towns that his parents and that their grandparents had told them about that weren't safe for Black people, particularly at sundown. And I remember getting to Southwest Georgia in the 80s and 90s. And those being places where if you were white, you could call Black elders by their first name. But those same Black elders were calling younger white people by their last name, putting a proper handle on it. And so the summers as a child, amazing. As a city kid running barefoot and realizing as a city kid how tender your feet are because the ground is hot in Georgia. Learning what ditches were and falling into them and dropping bikes into them. It enjoying everything about being a child. What I'll never forget and can never forget is the travel route and the stark differences between Jersey and Georgia and the phenomenology of sundown towns.
Wow. Were you ready for that, Melina?
No. I was not expecting that. I receive it. I heard it. Thank you, Lawrence, for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My summers were, at least as I remember them now, were lit. Like from June 15th to I'm a Virgo as well. I always went back to school around my birthday. First day of school was always around my birthday. So all the stuff I received, all the gifts I received for my birthday were like school clothes. That's how that went. But man, I played hide and go seek until sometimes 10, 11, midnight. July 4th was huge on my block. We used to have a block party every summer for 4th of July. And we were just, and I was, for all intents and purposes, I was one of the boys. I was huge. I know this red, don't let this red lip fool you. I was out there with the boys playing street hockey, football, soccer, like all of the things. And we, had a blast. We had fireworks that we'd go get in New Hampshire and we'd bring them back down. And barbecues and just out all night with the street, closed and kids running amok. The summer was just an amazing time. We didn't travel. So I'm the oldest of four. All of my family is in Massachusetts. So there was no one to visit. And we were too poor to get on a plane and go to Puerto Rico. So I spent every summer in Massachusetts until that one summer my mom sent me to Interlochen Camp in New Hampshire. And that was a wild time. I had never been anywhere so white. And I was not like a huge fan of the outdoors. I was like, what the hell am I doing here? You want me to sleep where? I was in a cabin, y'all. Like, not even, sorry. I was in a tent, a huge tent. There were four beds in it. It had a planked full floor, like 2x4s. And I had a mosquito net over my cot. It was the ghetto. The ghetto. And then, do you know where I had to brush my teeth? They had this communal sink that was huge. It looked like a kiddie pool. And I had to brush my teeth there every morning. The shower looked like a coffin. The wood was rotted, and like it was just it, they plopped it like in a field, and you just walked there with all your crap, took a shower, walked back to my tent, and there were spider webs and spiders in that shower, like as big as my head. I will never forget that summer. I am not an outdoor girly, even though I love to hike. That's it. That's it. Anyway, my summers were amazing.
Minus the
It
camp.
sounds like you're a glamper, not a camper.
I am a glamper to the couch. I need a hot tub, hot water. I need a stove. And I'm not sharing any more sinks. Do not put me in a tent with a mosquito net, please.
Oh, man, our lives were different. So, to all our listeners, I grew up in Texas and New Mexico. So, we cover half of the continental United States. And my summers growing up, we primarily lived in the country, except for when I was really young. And the area I'm from in Texas is the Panhandle. And around Lubbock, Texas, my family moved a lot. And so, I spent most of my summers in cotton fields and in desert like cap rocks, trying to avoid rattlesnakes, poking tarantulas with broom handles because they like to stand up and hiss. Yelling for my parents when the dogs got into a porcupine, being cautious of the coyotes. And it was all flat. It was all brown. There's not a lot of grass where I'm from. There's a lot of oil rigs, which are the pump jacks. A lot of fun to ride when you're in high school. Don't do that, kids. That is dangerous. But, you know, I grew up in the country. And I had an aunt and uncle that managed a quarter horse racetrack. So I grew up around a lot of horses. I loved horses. And my mother was the youngest of 10. And my daughter was my father was one of three. And their families were very involved. And so I spent a lot of time by myself. I loved to read. I loved to be outside. It was all about my animals. We had a god sister that we grew up with. My brother and I are only about 18 months apart. We were very close, but I was very bossy, Virgo. and, you know, but I remember at 9 years old, sitting in my dogs. I always had dogs. It was a white German Shepherd. Her name was Regen, Jenny Ray backwards. And I remember sitting in her doghouse in the sweltering heat in the summer, in August, with a typewriter that I had carried that my mother had. And I remember the click, clack, click, clack very clearly from when I tried to write my first novel about animals who had been mistreated.
Listen.
9 years old. Nothing.
This is very yeah, on brand. Correct. This is very on brand.
So, you know, that was a lot of my summers. I grew up in the church, so I went to a lot of church camps. I'm fairly certain at least one of them, I was there as forced labor.
Ah.
Which, if we want to get into the religious trauma at some point, I got stuff to share.
That's another episode. Because I grew up Catholic.
Yes. But I also grew up in sports. And sports were a huge part of my life. And so as I got old enough, that became my whole summer with sports. That and FFA, Future Farmers of America. You know, you got to cover your bases.
Jesus. Wow.
Yeah, he was there too. Supposedly.
Supposedly. Okay. Rapid fire. Ready?
Let's go.
All right. Favorite childhood TV show?
Ooh, for me, favorite childhood TV show, A Different World. I still think that Hillman is a real college campus. A Different World.
Okay. Jenny?
Ooh, Land of the Lost. Oh. I had a thing for dinosaurs for a while.
The Cosby Show. I know it's controversial now. It wasn't then. enough said.
It was awesome.
Right. All right. Top three albums of all time. I know I just broke your head, Lawrence. I know.
I know. Well, I'll dance across genres. If I think about R&B, take boy bands to the extent that they're not. New Edition, Any Heartbreak, Argue With Your Mama. I will take Jay-Z's The Blueprint, and I'll take Biggie, Ready to Die.
Wow. Okay. I'm going to say I won't jump too far across genres, but I'm going to say Queen 2 by Queen. I'm going to say Jade Dilla Donuts. And I'm going to say Ready to Die. B.I.G. Honorable mention, Lil' Kim. Sorry, I shouldn't have been listening to that damn music when I was young either.
Hardcore. I'm just doing the chronology. I'm like, you was in middle school.
I was. I was. I should not have been listening to that. But here we are. I'm okay.
Well,
for the most part.
Oh, I'm going to have to go with Prince, Purple Rain.
Oh.
Okay, I'm going to cheat a little.
Oh God, here we go.
Tupac greatest hits. Like, if you put it in the greatest hits, you get all the albums.
That is cheating, by the way.
And I'm gonna have to go Cowboy Carter. Not only because I have tickets
This is a
in
hot
May
take. This
in
is a hot
Chicago,
take. Okay.
but I grew up with country music and hip hop. That was like the genres I grew up listening to. And when I was thinking about like greatest albums of all time, I was like I grew up with country. And I was like, ooh, or do I say Nina Simone, or do I? But when I think of all of the different genres on that album, like there's 50 to 100 years of different types of music on that album, and it blows me away. So I think that's gonna be one of the greatest of all time.
That's a good one. Okay.
I got the stank face from Lawrence. That one, he was happy with
Oh no,
that
Cowboy Carter, I'm with it. That was envy because you said you had concert tickets.
Oh yeah.
Beyonce acting like eggs aren't at an all-time high. So
Right.
that's what that was. It was the high egg high egg face.
And the new perfume
Yeah.
that I'll never afford because I bought tickets.
Right. Exactly. All right. What book, film, or experience profoundly influenced your perspective on education? I'll go first because I queued mine up. Lean on Me, Morgan Freeman. That 1989. When the young boys were in the bathroom and Morgan Freeman walks in and he has them sing their rendition. He didn't know at the time it was their rendition, but it was their rendition of the school song, Dear Eastside. And I can still like the scene gave me chills. And I'll say that the scene gave me chills because every time I watch that part, I cry. Because he was so in awe of those boys and all of them and their stories, like each deserved an outstanding education. And they were outstanding black boys, each and every single one of them. And then y'all remember Joe had the bat, and he used to tell those gangsters to stay out of the schools, and he used to lock the doors and all of that. It
They
reminds
used to call me Crazy Joe.
great.
Now they call me Batman.
Yes! And him protecting those babies in that school remind me of how teachers and principals now need to be protecting their schools and these babies from ICE.
Yes.
Because if we're not protecting kids and we're just handing them over to the police state, what are we really doing? It's almost like we are breaking our Hippocratic oaths to do no harm. Anyway, that's mine.
Yeah, I don't follow rules well.
Here we go.
Here we go. I'm gonna share one personal experience and I'll share a movie as well. The personal experience was because I came from what was perceived to be a lower income family. And this was Texas in the 80s and early 90s, right? So when you think about standardized testing and tracking, you know, Texas has a lot of power in the field of education, particularly public education. They're now really trying hard to get into the private education game,
Yeah,
but
they are.
they've had a lot of power. That's where you get standardized tests, that's where you get textbooks. And I remember I was in the second grade and I was in a class that was not one of the higher level classes. And I was quiet in school, but they gave us the standardized test. This is one of the early versions. And I had one of the top scores in the state. And so, like, they think something's wrong. Like, they call my parents in, they have a meeting, and they gave me one of the gifted and talented tests. And I remember almost being ashamed. And, like, I had done something wrong because I had exceeded their expectations. Because in my mind, I wasn't doing anything different. And so then they moved me into a different class. And instead of sitting around a table and, like, kids making fun of each other, we were in rows. It's also where I had my first crush. Her name was Amanda. She had pigtails. I remember distinctly, like, we were passing a paper in, and I was so nervous and scared, and I erased her name off the paper and put mine because I was so new to all of this. And who knows, maybe I was trying to flirt, but second grade, y'all. But I got called in for cheating. And so then there was, like, this assumption that somehow I had cheated my way into the classroom. And that truly stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, growing up in those 80s and 90s, then I was tracked into gifted and talented. Mm-hmm. And there's so much about my education experience that was opportunity and obstacles because of the culture around education that I grew up in. And I'm really fortunate that, you know, I had parents that fed me books and a house that, you know, my dad read Westerns, but that was it. And so I think that's the experience for me that made me think so much about how education just never worked for me. Like, by the time I was in fifth grade, they were pulling me out to take me to the middle school to go find books I could read because I had read all the books. And then the same thing happened when I was middle school, taking me to high school. But it wasn't something I could be proud of. And so I think that just the impact of that in a system that's supposed to be about education, but is actually built not to push you or honor you when you succeed. And so that's my personal experience. Now I'm going to share my movie. And I'm going to prepare right now for y'all to judge me. Because
we listen and we do judge.
And it's because it follows the white savior trope.
Mm.
But there was something about it. And I decided early on that I wanted to be in education. I remember saying in high school, I want to be an educator. But it was Dangerous Minds. And
Michelle
Pfeiffer. Michelle Pfeiffer.
As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death.
But that was one of the first actual education movies I saw. And I was like, oh, there are people who do this who want people to do well.
Mm.
So, you, yeah, I have that whole thing that just came out of my mouth I had not thought of. So thank you, Melina. You're supposed to be rapid fire.
Okay. I love that. I think I'll return this to rapid fire. The most shaping, impactful educational experience happened my senior year in high school. And I think for educators and for families, it's an important listen. The question becomes, in a school setting, who introduced me to my first Black books? His name is Jack Roslowski. Jack Roslowski is currently the president of Xavier High School, there's a name, Melina, in New York City, which is the largest all-boys private Catholic school in New York State. He was the principal at St. Peter's Prep, where I was a senior. And for the first time in all of my education, there was a course dedicated to Black contributions in the humanities. It was African American Lit Survey. And it was an anthology curated by Henry Louis Skip Gates, for those folks who know Henry Louis Gates. And it was an anthology of poets, of leaders, throughout the Harlem Renaissance, which is where I got introduced to James Baldwin and Langston Hughes and W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. But what was most impactful was the first piece was a very short, rather, for my sophisticated 17-year-old mind, inarticulate essay, poem, and it was written by Lucy Terry. It's called Bars Fight, but she is, at least in terms of written and recorded literature, the first Black female poet. And that class, African American Lit Survey, was not only taught by a beautiful, short, Jack will appreciate it, Polish man from Hoboken, New Jersey. He was also the principal who used the cachet as principal to make sure that a class that needed to be taught was taught. It was my introduction to Black expression vis-a-vis the arts. And instead of a single piece of work, it was an entire anthology. Shouts to Jack Roslowski. If you ever want to know who is the Dr. Frankenstein behind this, know that you also have white people to blame. You are welcome.
Oh my God, I love that. I really do. All right. What was your job before you ever set foot in a school? What were you doing before education?
Barfending? I mean, I ran the gamut, you know. I was a bartender. I worked third shift at a Chevy auto parts factory in Indiana. I was an assistant to a golf pro at a golf course in Indiana. I worked as a telemarketer at one point. I've been a head lifeguard. I've been like, I've just like you, if you name a job, I've done it. But I do want to say that I think the food service industry, and specifically being a bartender, connects you to humanity in a really important way. And I think that that shaped so much of how I see the world.
I love that, Jenny. You lived a whole life. I thought about the question as we were preparing, Melina, and I think this is just a good note for the MEI group, the merit folks. I really had to go through my own resume. I've always been an educator. I was an RA undergrad. As soon as I graduated, I was working in higher education, moved to social work and secondary education. I was made to be an educator. And so I've literally not only never thought about anything other than this is what I was made to do, what I studied, what my master's is in. And that's not for the two of these awesome folks here as the audience. There are a lot of us who didn't trip into this. My greatest mentor is my Uncle Richard, who passed 2 years ago, lifelong Newark educator. You're talking about Joe Clark, lifelong educator in Newark, New Jersey, taught at, for folks who are familiar with New Jersey, some of the most nefarious high schools in the country, Weequay, Westside, and Barringer High Schools. He famously taught at Westside High School in his social studies class, a young man at the time, whose name was Reggie Noble. That's all he went by. Folks in the know that Reggie Noble now goes by the artist named Redman. So I was inspired by educators as long as I can remember. Since I've been in school, education is where I've been.
Like a purist. Look at this. I was a property manager before I was in education, and I did that for years. I was a realtor as well. When I was a property manager, I managed low-income housing tax credit properties. They were huge, 300, 400 apartments. In the Franklin Park Zoo area of Boston. I'll tell you a quick story. The reason I had and she, I doubt she'll ever see this, but I had an administrative assistant, and she was from around the way. She lived in like almost like the sister property. The sister property is where Bobby Brown was from, and Bobby and Whitney used to still smoke crack in that area when they came into town. You always knew they were there because there was a Bentley parked outside. So she was from that neighborhood, and then but she worked in you know, the neighborhood that I managed, and she had a son, and he was murdered at a bus stop on his way to school one morning. He was eating a honey bun sandwich when he was shot in the head. I remember going to his funeral, and that was the only child's funeral I had ever gone to. I've never had to go to another child's funeral since, and I hope to never attend another child's funeral. And in that experience, I said to myself, I need to do something else. I was managing a $3.1 million budget. I was managing 30 people. It was fun. No 2 days were alike, but I looked at the system that I was managing. I had three generations of one family in the same housing project. And I was like, there has to be a way to stop this. Like, this was made, built to do this to families, to murder them young. There's a reason why there's no green space, right? There's a reason why a lot of them don't get out. And I thought to myself, what can I do? What can I do that can help stop this? And I said, I can become an educator. And so I did. And that's kind of how I tripped into education. Yeah, but I was a waiter. I was a skip tracer. If you don't know what that is, Google it. It was weird and fun. I was a cashier at a car dealership. My first job was I was a coat check girl at the Town Line Lounge in Linfield, Massachusetts. So, you know, I've done it all. But yeah, that's what I was doing before education. All right, last question, y'all. Ready? What would you be doing if you weren't doing this? If you weren't doing education, if you weren't doing DEI, if you weren't doing higher ed, what would you be doing? Now, as a purist, I'm really interested to hear what else calls you.
I would be doing the thing that most people who know me, and even if you don't, it looks like I'd be doing. I'd be coaching youth football. Mm-hmm. I have no interest in high school kids. They think they know everything. No interest in college because they definitely don't know everything. I would be coaching youth sports, which is why I coach my 7-year-old son's flag football team. So if it remotely paid the bills and I could do it full time, I would be coaching the Tiny Tykes, Friday Night Tykes. That would be me.
I love that. Ginny.
Well, number one, I feel like Lawrence would give the best nicknames to his players. Like, no question. Like, you know, the good coaches, they never call a player by their real name. That's Lawrence.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I think I'd be doing one of two things. I would either be in the legal field. Probably this is where you got me, because like civil rights law would be like my thing. But I would also love to be an artist. Like, to spend my days writing and painting and creating art for the world. There's a part of my brain that functions in that way that the world doesn't make room for me to express. And so I would probably be painting and writing every day.
I'd be a lawyer.
No way.
Yeah, the end. I was back in the day, I was a fashion blogger.
Of
And
course.
yeah, when I lived in New York City, and I really loved it. I love styling folks. I love styling myself. I still do. But yeah, I would, but that didn't fulfill all of this. And so I would definitely be a lawyer. Human, civil rights, maybe immigration, I don't know. Something like that. But yeah. All right. Thanks, y'all.
Listen, all things considered, you did a great job. See what I did there? Hey, by the
Thank
way, everybody, Melina Phillips from NPR's All Things Considered. Give it up for the lift, folks. Give it up for the lift. Yeah, yes, y'all. Yeah.
Oh, man.